When I arrived here by stratocruiser just before Christmas, 2 months ago, you could cut with a knife the difference in the political climate. I'm not talking about the other climate, it seems much the same. You could cut with a difference, with a knife, the political climate between London and Washington. Not since I brought the first debating team from Oxford here 30 years ago have I known such a genuine difference in the political climate between our two countries. Old friendships, of course, remained. But the cleavage not only existed when I came here, but it's equally strong today. And this evening I want to try and deal with that in the course of my address. The challenge made by communism, of course, is not new. There is nothing new about it. It's as old as 1848 and Karl Marx. It's existed in fact since 1917, and only recently has it resumed the offensive in a dangerous form. And I think the more obvious reasons for it, for its appeal in the last decade, can be listed. Firstly, there's the contempt and distrust of parliamentary government, which was aroused in many countries in the original collapse against Germany and Japan. National Socialism, Italian Fascism, and Leninism have very much in common. They all claim to give moral as well as political guidance, in fact, to give a code and a discipline. Well, our governments don't quite go as far as that. We leave a few things to the church, the university, and various other things. They are all exaggerations of economic nationalism. They all depend on absolute control of what are called mass media. In each case, in these countries, the key portfolios are the ministries of the interior, which means the police, and information, and possibly, one might add, education. If you've got the Tommy gun and the radio, you've got the lot. That's what happened in Czechoslovakia. That's what happened all across Europe. No literature of any sort has been produced under these regimes. Secondly, linked with this distrust of parliamentary government, there's been a wide desire for strong and efficient government in the post-World War, owing to the inevitable chaos. Thirdly, communism offered opportunities for political activity and power. It appealed to enthusiasm. Communism, unlike National Socialism and Fascism, had a universal appeal. To large numbers of urban workers, it made fantastic promises. To peasants in undeveloped countries, it promised land reforms. And it championed the case against the European and his so-called colonialism. In fact, it increased its power in Europe and Asia by brilliant and unscrupulous methods. The reason why it's had less success in the United Kingdom, United States, and one might add Scandinavian countries, is to my mind quite simply because with all our faults, we have efficient government. I know that sounds somewhat strange to some of your ears, but you must let that pass. With all our faults, we have efficient government. We have social unity. We have highly organized relations between capital and labor. We have respect for the rule of law. Those are four important things. And above all, we have immunity from the worst effects of war. We have never suffered the dreadful humiliation of being occupied. And if I may repeat a somewhat cheap joke, which I seem to remember making here 3 years ago, Britain and America have never been occupied, except that England has always been occupied by the Scotch. That is a permanent and traditional thing. But if we are talking about occupation, neither of us have ever had at our doors. We've never known the Gestapo. We've never known our university president, as the presidents of Leiden, Louvain, Strasbourg have been in jail. Been in jail because they refused to give the names of their students to the Gestapo. And therefore, there is that very important difference. Now, in my opinion, the political and social improvement schemes which we have in our countries, more and more welfare state, whatever you like to call it, are not the only or necessarily the answer to communism. Neither undiluted socialism nor undiluted private enterprise will prevail or provide the answer to communism. Much less will any form of witch hunting and hysteria. Of course, we must take, in the interest of security, special precautions. But we must never slow down or straighten the liberal spirit, and I use that word in its grand old sense, on which the tradition of the free world's constructive purpose rests. The issue that we are facing today is fundamentally moral, and the alternative policy to be pursued over the next decade must be based on personal conviction rooted in respect for freedom and in a faith. The communists have a long roll of honor, almost a martyrology, as it's been called. But Jan Masaryk, the American boys in Korea, and scores of Catholic priests in Europe all belong to our roll of honor, though we seldom talk about it. We speak with conflicting voices, with different foreign policies, because our leaders, the politicians, have not made a common analysis of the malaise from which we are suffering. And scores of half-trained doctors, sometimes commentators and columnists, sometimes economists and political scientists, prescribe a dozen different remedies. We cannot oppose communism by a party of rigid discipline and totalitarian training, as Hitler and Mussolini fondly thought. That is obviously impossible. But the dedicated communist must be faced by other dedicated individuals, whether their inspiration is religious, political, or scientific. In the less developed areas of Asia and Africa, apart from military measures, we must have a concerted policy. We are faced with large increases in population. We know that during the next decade, these are some of the facts we know, nothing's going to alter them. There will be 300 million persons added to the world population. There were 300 million added during the last decade. The population in 1940 was about 2,000 million. Population today is 2,300 million. And the population in 1960 will be 2,600 million. And it's rather interesting where that's coming. India and Pakistan have increased by 40 million. Japan by 12. Indonesia, 10. And incidentally, the Soviet Union by 30. And this instability and rapid growth of population has been paralleled by a very uneven growth of knowledge in both the natural and the social sciences. Among the more obvious aspects of the problem, which, if we think about it, are very obvious, are the widening gulf between the early atomic age and the late stone age type of equipment and political and social organization, which now exist side by side. The huge psychological vacuum which has been created in most communities by the impact of science and the upsetting of old traditions beliefs and ways of life. The rubbing together of different types of cultures, as we get in Africa, is happening now in Korea, formerly insulated by geographical and other barriers. In fact, I would say that the problem of helping the scientifically have-not nations is fast emerging as a world problem almost comparable with that of slum control in the 20s and the 30s. You remember the great unemployment in your own country between 1930 and 1940. In fact, I believe at the time of Pearl Harbor, there was something like 5 million unemployed or more in this country. We had our what are called years of unemployment, what was called the slump. Now, I always remember, because of a rather silly story in the war, they were trying to get Mr. Churchill to attend to a document which dealt with full employment after the war. He never could be bothered with people who were always thinking about after the war. He wanted to get on with the war, you see. And he would never look at this paper. He said there were a lot of lily-livered people and all the rest of it. And finally, Sir John Anderson persuaded him that he really must attend to this paper on full employment. Well, just at that time, we were having Salute the Army Week, Salute the Navy Week. I expect you had the same sort of thing. So Winston Churchill finally said, well, I suppose I must look at this paper. What is it all about? It seems to me like Salute the Slump Week. Well, that's one description of full employment, but it's not the normal one. And it is true that the problem of unemployment was the thing which devastated your government under Roosevelt and our government under, everybody. Macdonald, Chamberlain, Baldwin, the whole lot. It was too big. As Charles Beard once said, politics comes after the facts, and the facts are economic. And I sometimes wonder how easy it was for the politicians to curse each other. Here is this great basic unemployment. And if I may say so, it's a fact which is well worth remembering, that unemployment in the United States today, as it did then, means unemployment in the world. A slight recession in 1949 of 3% in your employment figures suddenly sent a wave of despair across Europe, which partly accounted for our devaluation. Though, of course, the origins of it were much deeper. Now, just as that problem, which today doesn't exist, the problem in my country is, have we got too full employment? Some of the economists say it's much better to have 3 or 4% unemployment. And many of the capitalists don't like this. Keeps people too rigid. How do we know they're in the right place? There may be people making automobiles who ought to be making cotton goods. And if you have absolutely full employment, mayn't you also have direction of labor? But at any rate, you're not suffering from unemployment. We're not suffering from unemployment. The only place that I know is suffering from unemployment is Italy. And that's due to long-term reasons, which we won't go into. It's got something to do with, well, perhaps I better not go into it. I expect those of you who know Italy will know. The problem today, which takes the place of that, 1950 to 1960, is helping the scientifically have-not nation. That's a world problem. That's going to be a problem right the way through. This vast increase in population, which I mentioned, is going on. Why are you having to give from Congress the other day this large sum of grain to India? Mightn't it occur next year and the year afterwards? The more a country's got MITs and the scientific part of University of Illinois and Caltech, the more it has unto him that hath it shall be given. It's a curious sort of thing. And the more a country is undeveloped, the more difficult it is. Because once you've got science, science breeds science. And you know from your university, the degrees, the professors and assistant professors in one branch, it's terrific. And it's an accumulative thing. And equally, in countries which haven't got it, well, they just haven't got it. And it's a tremendous problem. It's not just a question of point four or the Colombo plan. It's a basic thing. There are these disequilibriums in the world. I think it was estimated the United States, with 6% of the world's population, in the 20s and 30s, had over 26% of the world's aggregate income. Now, you know, as I love this country, I will grant you all the virtues of the world. You are the most amazing people that ever lived. Granted that your technical abilities of the most tremendous form. The basic other reason is that you've got 3,000 miles of free trade. Plus, very great natural resources.